For the first 52 minutes of his first White House press conference yesterday, the Washington Press Corps asked President Joe Biden more than 7 questions about immigration at the southern border, 3 questions about his relationship with Congress, 4 about the filibuster, 3 about voting rights and gun control, 6 about foreign policy, and 4 about the next presidential election in 2024. Can you see my eye roll through the radio? Because questions about the pandemic? Zilch. And the number of questions asked about the gargantuan multi-trillion dollar infrastructure plan Biden's set to unveil next week? 0. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And hey, Biden's Build Back Better infrastructure plan could be the largest spending bill in U.S. history, potentially dwarfing the package that currently holds the number one spot, the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan, which Biden signed into law just 2 weeks ago. Now, the White House press corps may not be interested in roads, bridges, tunnels, and ports, but we are. So I was kind of relieved when, at the end of the press conference, Biden himself brought it up, ticking off a grim list of America's crumbling infrastructure.
Bridges, more than one-third of our bridges, 231,000 of them, need repairs. Some are physical safety risks or preservation work. 1 in 5 miles of our highways and major roads are in poor condition. That's 186,000 miles of highway. Aviation, 20% of all flights, 20% of all flights weren't on time, resulting in 1.5 million hours lost in production. 6 to 10 million homes in America still have lead pipes servicing their water lines.
Now, about that last one, about drinking water in America. The problem isn't just brittle, toxic lead pipes. It's treatment plants, storage tanks, reservoirs, aging, fragile water systems underfoot in so many places, meaning that communities across the country are one mishap away from having no clean water at all.
As you are aware, our infrastructure is not prepared for the winter weather that we often experience.
That's Jackson, Mississippi Mayor Chokwe Antar Lumumba speaking at the onset of a severe winter storm that crippled parts of the South last month. The storm first caused Jackson's water treatment plants to fail, and then the pipes burst throughout the system. So for weeks, tens of thousands of residents, including Summer Williams, had no running water.
The city wasn't prepared, and there was no warning about there not being water. It just stopped working unexpectedly.
The National Guard was called in to distribute water. 2 weeks later, when system pressure was restored, Jackson residents would still be under a boil water advisory for almost a month. South Jackson resident R.J. Boss told Vice News he had to get creative to find water for his 2 children.
We didn't have water for about a week and a half, and now, even though that the water is back, it doesn't really have many uses besides really the toilet like that anyway, because we're on a boil water notice. We still have to buy a lot of bottled water.
Is this the first time that you guys have dealt with water issues here?
Not really. Normally, every time it gets cold, like the infrastructure is so bad, every time it gets cold, like below 30, I'd say, there's always water mains breaking and people losing power.
When you guys were without water, where were you getting water from, like different distribution
sites? There's a creek in the backyard, actually, and some of the water in there didn't freeze all the way. So we were actually having to take buckets and fill up garbage cans.
That creek is a muddy ditch. Jackson is Mississippi's largest city. It's more than 80% black. The city's water infrastructure is a century old. Modernizing it could cost more than $1 billion. That's 3 times more than Jackson's entire annual city budget. Mayor Chokwe Antar Lumumba says the water disaster has happened before. It is certain to happen again, and not just in the Mississippi state capital.
The winter storm crippled, it debilitated our system. You know, it is an illustration of the fact that cities are in need of resources to repair aged infrastructure. And Jackson is not necessarily an exception to the rule. Many of our legacy cities are suffering in the same regard.
So today on Point, water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. We are going to talk about America's aging water infrastructure system. And we'll start with Donald Ladd, editor of the Mississippi Free Press and the Jackson Free Press, and a resident of Jackson, Mississippi. Donna, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Magna.
So first of all, tell us, what has it been like over the past month with so much uncertainty around your drinking water?
Well, it was awful, and I didn't lose water completely, and it was still awful. You know, it was levels of awful, and you know, we were under boil water notice here and had to buy bottled water, et cetera. But the, you know, people who are in the areas of town that were the toughest hit, such as South Jackson and West Jackson, which are majority Black, were just devastated because they didn't have water for weeks in most cases. Mm-hmm. And couldn't flush. I mean, it was just terrible.
Yeah. Well, that South Jackson resident you heard there a minute ago, he was talking about this having happened before, not just once, in terms of the losing access to clean water. I mean, how frequent is this in Jackson?
Well, water main breaks happen here continually. It's just a thing. Boil water notices are a thing. You know, they come out so often that it's hard to report them all. Now, they're not usually citywide, mm-hmm. boil water notices at once. That's the big difference, because the whole system shut down this time. What is our typical situation is that parts of the system can't handle, to make it really simplistic, but parts of the system can't handle what's trying to go through their pipes or there are various components of the system that are so outdated. And so so that means that different parts of the city will end up with boil water alerts or, you know, terrible, you know, brown water.
Yeah.
I mean, you just don't know what's in it. I think we kind of live in a perpetual state of not sure what's in our water.
Ugh. Now, in this case, because of the storm having sort of temporarily knocked out the water treatment plants, that's one of the mm-hmm. reason why, and also the storm sort of hit everywhere, but those are some of the reasons why there was a citywide challenge. So
right.
We had upstream issues and then also downstream issues with just the delivery system as well. But,
right.
you know, there has been lots of coverage about what has happened in Jackson. Mm-hmm. And I want to hear from you, Donna, as you know, a lifetime resident there. What would you say, you know, is the cause of, like you said, like just uncertainty around water is a thing there. That seems to be an intolerable thing. So what's the cause of it?
Well, to use words that my reporter, Nick Juden, used, it's a complex system collapse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and when we say that, it's not just the technological part of the system. It's the fact that we've known this for years is coming in one way or another. I mean, we know it. There was a big 2013 study that warned about all of these things. So we know the conditions of them, but there's a systemic breakdown in the willingness to actually do something about it. And the city itself, because, you know, like so many cities in the U.S., because of flight and disinvestment and, you know, losing the tax base, and in this case, losing 40,000 residents, taking us from 200,000 to 160,000, but we still have a huge land mass of city with, you know, these outdated pipes under them. So we can't afford to keep it up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, as we're finding, as we report more and more, it's a systemic breakdown of federal, state, and local, municipal areas being able to work together to solve problems together in basic things like infrastructure.
Yeah, and systemic and decades, if not longer, in terms of the system breakdown here. But, you know, I mean, as you know, on I think it was fairly recently, the lieutenant governor of the state of Mississippi, Delbert Hoseman, I mean, he criticized Jackson's political leadership. And he said, quote, "You remember during Kane Ditto's administration? He did repair work on water and sewer. So what happened since then?" Referring to, I believe, Jackson's last white mayor. Is that right?
That's right. And that was in answer to a question from our reporter, Nick. And Nick recognized immediately, because he's from here too, recognized, hey, that's the last white mayor. What? You know? And he was texting me. And so we followed that up very quickly. And it really kind of enabled, it wasn't a good thing to say, but it enabled us to start talking about this long time systemic racism and attitudes toward our black leaders. You know, Nick talked to Harvey Johnson, who I think you're talking to today, and who was our first black mayor, and he had followed Kane Ditto, and under his administration, they found $200 million to put into a water system problem that they had inherited. I'm not saying it was Ditto's fault, because it's been going on, as you said, for decades. You know, there are pipes that are a century old. And so... But it's just this attitude, you know. One way Nick put it to me is that we just think that a lot of these of our statewide politicians who happen to be white just unplug from what's happening, from the reality of what's happening in Jackson, in their capital city, and just don't feel responsible for the people who live here.
Yeah. Well, Donna, hang on for just a quick second, if you could, because we have to take a quick break. And by the way, just for folks who don't know, Kane Ditto's final term in Jackson ended in 1997. So the insinuation there from the lieutenant governor is there's been no investment since then, which isn't true. So we'll talk more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the nation's fragile water system, focusing for the moment on Jackson, Mississippi, but asking what lessons Jackson has to teach the rest of the country. We will zoom out to talk about national-level water woes in just a moment. But I'm joined today by Donna Ladd. She's founding editor of the Mississippi Free Press and Jackson Free Press as well. And Donna, just listen along with me for a little bit, because I do want to drive home to folks what it is like to not have reliable access to clean water. So this is Nancy Sylvester. She's the director of Global Learning Connection Center, a daycare for children of teenage moms in Jackson, Mississippi. And she was at work when we talked to her.
Miss Linda, tell Miss Linda to which baby is that?
Now, the Global Learning Connection Center is located in the Jackson Medical Mall, which meant that after last month's storm, the center was able to access an emergency water source, but it was non-potable water, so they couldn't use it for most things.
Even when we washed hands, we had to pour the bottled water over the hands and then use sanitizer. And then the purchased water was used in the kitchen. We purchased a pump that would go on the 5-gallon jugs of water and would pump water for cooking so that we could warm it on the stove for dishwashing. It was a major chore. I told my cook and assistant director, I feel like we owe them a whole lot more than they were paid for that time that we went through all of that, because it was very difficult.
And as anyone who set foot in a child care center for even 1 minute knows, babies and toddlers in their joyful, sticky innocence need a whole lot of water to stay clean, and even more so in a pandemic.
We had bottles of water just sitting everywhere where you could, the teachers could pull it as they needed it, and so that they could make sure that their kids weren't getting any contamination. Because little children have such a tendency to put their hands in their mouths or to lick things. I mean, it's just, it's what they do. So we had to make sure everything was cleaned with clean water and sanitized.
Meanwhile, many of the families the center serves didn't have water at home either.
I heard stories from parents about melting the snow and chipping ice and letting it melt just so they would have water to, you know, for flushing at home. A lot of them went through. It was very difficult, especially those who had little children at home, the breastfeeding moms. It was pretty hard for them.
And as a mom who breastfed her kiddos, I can absolutely say then you got to keep all the equipment clean too, which you need clean water for. Now, this isn't Miss Sylvester's first time dealing with a water outage. She recently moved to nearby Clinton, but she's worked in Jackson for 40 years.
We've been through this numerous times, even years back. I can remember when we had to close schools because there was no water, because I was working in the school district during that time. And we had to close schools because of water main breaks and what have you. But I feel that when the city officials are saying, we don't have the means of getting it done, and then we're the capital city, I feel that there does need to be some assistance offered. I'm just one of those people that believe when there's a need, you know, everyone should rally around and help whoever there is in need.
That's Nancy Sylvester, director of Global Learning Connection Center in Jackson. And Nancy also told us that as of this week, the water is back on there and the boil water advisory is over, but they're waiting until next week at least to let the children drink the water just in case. That question of trusting the supply. Now, Donna Ladd, you know, I think Nancy there helps us pick up where we left off earlier, which is what has the city, or what have state officials done over the past couple of decades to attend to this known problem?
Well, I think the best way to break it down is to say, you know, staunching the bleeding, you know, the Band-Aid approach as far as the city itself is concerned. I mean, I can't personally, you know, I can't sit here and blame a city that is as beleaguered as our city has been for not having the resources to be able to overhaul the water system. You know, some of the numbers that we've come up with, the least amount that they need is $600 million. And then, as you said earlier, it keeps climbing from there. I mean, if the money's not here, the money's not here. So what that means is that the state should be at the same table with the city, side by side. This is the capital city. You know, the state is no stronger than its capital city. That's absurd. And so they should be side by side with the city saying, okay, how are we going to work together to get federal help? How are we going? What is it that we can do? Mm-hmm. How can we help? But the opposite happens. Like, you know, one of the things our governor said just recently was, well, you know, Jackson residents should pay their water bills, or they should go collect the water bill. Well, there's a whole issue around faulty billing that we've been through. But beyond that, it's like the city tried to get the state and the legislature passed legislation to allow payment plans for the water bills. And the governor vetoed it last year. And so that's like working against us, you know? And so the money doesn't come in. But the water billing money is not enough to pay mm-hmm. for what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
It has to be, and we have to work with the federal government. As we've discovered, you know, a lot of the disinvestment in helping municipal areas across the country came during the 80s, and particularly the Reagan era, which was kind of pulling back on financial assistance over for environmental improvements, those kinds of things. And that is one of those perfect storm moments where it got so much worse afterward as far as not being able to pay for things. And so when you've got everybody working against each other or ignoring each other, then it's a terrible situation.
Which the residents of Jackson have to endure again and again and again. Well,
that's right. And it's about the people of Jackson. And that's what's so infuriating about it. Mm-hmm. It's looking at it like the people here don't matter. And we get that so often from many of our state leaders. It's this condescension and, you know, there's this attitude that black leaders can't run things well. You know, you see it on the conservative blogs, you know, all of these things from people who aren't even bothering to look at the actual facts of how it got this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Donna Ladd, founding editor of the Mississippi Free Press and Jackson Free Press, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for doing the story, Magna.
So as Donna walked us through, this is a long, ongoing problem that's a result of politics, lack of coordination, finger-pointing, lack of maintenance, lack of money. It all sort of compounds, those factors all compound each other. Now, we want to note again one thing that I mentioned earlier, that Mississippi Lieutenant Governor Delbert Hoseman told journalists earlier this month that, quote, the prime mover needs to be the city itself, and that he talked about his belief that the last time that Jackson's water system was adequately maintained was during Kane Ditto's administration. Quote, he did repair work on water and sewer, so what happened since then? Again, Kane Ditto being the last white mayor of Jackson. His term ended in 1997. Well, we talked to Harvey Johnson Jr., the first black mayor of Jackson, who served right after Kane Ditto from 1997 to 2005, and then again from 2009 to 2013. He's also an urban planner and, if I can put it this way, kind of an infrastructure guy. And during his tenure, the city actually spent $200 million on the water infrastructure. And Johnson says the city just needs more help.
I'm troubled when I hear people say that, you know, failed leadership and the city hasn't been carrying its load and it wants a handout now from the state or from the federal government. That's simply not true. This is a nationwide problem that has to be addressed through some sort of national policy and that will help solve the problem.
Well, joining us now is Aaron Packman, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. He's with us from Chicago. Professor Packman, welcome to you.
Thank you, Migna.
And also with us is Catherine Coleman Flowers, author of Waste, One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret. She's also a 2020 MacArthur Fellow for Environmental Health Advocacy, and she joins us from Montgomery, Alabama. Welcome to you, Catherine.
Thank you very much.
So, Aaron, let's start with this. How emblematic are the water infrastructure challenges, endemic, that Jackson, Mississippi has been facing? How emblematic is that of the nation's water infrastructure writ large in other parts of the country?
Well, it was very terrible to hear of the suffering of the people of Jackson without water supply, but sadly, this is becoming more common across the country.
And how common would you say it is?
So that varies quite a lot by region because our water infrastructure is different everywhere across the country, different age, different state of reliability. But in many places, there are persistent issues with water safety, water insecurity, and lack of water supply.
Mm. And is it because of, let's just focus on the actual physical infrastructure itself. Is it because it, you know, it's aging, hasn't been maintained? You know, what we keep using this phrase crumbling. Is that a fair description of some of these systems?
Most of the infrastructure we have in the eastern half of the United States is quite old. Just for a point of comparison, I live in Chicago. We're still using the water intakes from Lake Michigan that were built in the 1860s. And in places like Philadelphia, the water infrastructure goes back 300 years. So clearly, infrastructure of that age needs a lot of maintenance to work properly. And it's very hard to do because most of the pipes are underground and inaccessible. So we definitely have an issue with its aging, deteriorating water infrastructure in a lot of the country.
Yeah. Now, so we're talking about century, if not multiple centuries old in some places, this system here. And, you know, Jackson's current problem is citywide, and it's quite breathtaking. But as we heard Donna say earlier, it's very common there. I'm wondering if part of the issue is that in other places, the fragility of the water system is actually quite invisible until it breaks, right? I'm just thinking about, I'm here sitting in the Boston area, and it was, I don't know, a decade ago or so, I can't quite remember, where one water main cracked in one city, but it was a big one. So residents in surrounding municipalities were all put under a boil water notice for quite some time, but it just took one crack in one pipe, is my point. So so it seems like maybe perhaps that kind of thing actually happens far more often than we pay attention to.
Oh, certainly there are a lot of local disruptions that don't get a lot of attention. I think the core issue is that most people in the U.S. don't appreciate the level of effort and investment and long-term buildup that was required to deliver safe, clean water to their house. And it's kind of amazing that we can just walk through the tap, you have perfectly good purified water come out at any time. And so that lack of understanding of the difficulty in delivering water to people safely, I think means it just doesn't get attention on an ongoing basis.
Doesn't get attention, and then perhaps doesn't get the adequate continuous funding in order to maintain or even modernize these systems. Catherine Coleman-Flowers, let me turn to you. Your first thoughts on how widespread the challenges around water are in the United States.
I think the challenges around water and wastewater in the United States are much larger than people know. Most people that tend to be questioned about this in the media are coming from very much from an urban perspective, because in urban areas, they don't have the kind of problems that I see in rural communities. And, you know, when just listening, talking about the time and effort that went into delivering water, you know, I grew up in an area where we had to dig our own well and have our own electric pump. It was years later. It was only in the 1970s and 80s when we even got water in a lot of those rural communities, especially in Lowndes County, Alabama, which is between Selma and Montgomery. However, I'm seeing problems with wastewater infrastructure all over the country, including in Illinois. I spent some time in Centerville, which is outside of St. Louis, but is in the state of Illinois. And I've been talking to people at the University of Illinois, where I serve as a Levenick scholar. And there are wastewater problems and water issues throughout southern Illinois as well. So these rural communities tend to hide, or these small towns tend to hide the problems that's been going on for many, many years, because in a lot of cases, they didn't get the money. They don't get the infrastructure. They don't have the lobbyists or connected with the big firms that will go after the money to keep maintaining their systems over and over again. Or in the case of poor communities or black communities, even in Jackson, one of the things that I hear over and over again, that it was the black parts of town that suffered the most. That's generally because we're the last one to get infrastructure, and we get the worst or the cheapest infrastructure, and then we're left to maintain it. While people that make the money off of it, they don't look back. And we need to change the engineering paradigm so that we can find some real solutions. And I think that whether it's, especially with on-site sanitation in rural communities, that if government money is used and people install it or design it, it should come with a warranty, mm-hmm. that at least lasts the life of a house. You know, that's not happening. So there's no accountability. Uh-huh. And that's why you have failing infrastructure worse in communities of color or poor communities than anywhere else.
Aaron Packman, do you want to respond to that? We've just got about 30 seconds before we have to take our next break.
I completely agree. And there's two main issues. So one is that there are different rules that apply for large cities and smaller communities in the tens of thousands of people range. And then secondly, most of the funding for building this infrastructure comes from the federal government, but the maintenance costs are borne by local governments. And in places that are small and don't have a good resource base, they don't have a lot of engineering staff, that's very difficult to do.
Mm. Well, we are talking about America's fragile water systems, what it'll take to modernize and to maintain it, and what are the risks for as long as we don't. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmanning, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about America's fragile water infrastructure. Here's listener KCB from Oklahoma City, who talked about water problems where he lives.
In the last big winter storm that we had, we experienced 31 mainline breaks in Oklahoma City Metro, which did cause about 4 to 5 days of no running water, period. And so we did a lot of melting snow in the bathtub for dogs and for toilet flushing. Once the water came back, we did have to do a boil for about a day because there was E. coli in the lines. As far as long-term, I'm not as concerned day-to-day, but as future storms occur, I'm sure that I'm going to be more and more concerned with our ability to do simple things like drink water.
Thoughts about the future of water from a listener in Oklahoma City. I'm joined today by Catherine Coleman Flowers. She's author of Waste, One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret. She's also a member of the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force on Climate Change and founding director of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. Aaron Packman joins us as well, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. And I want to talk with both of you for a minute about the cost of maintenance and how we, maybe just the sheer fact about how we pay for water might be part of the problem here. Because we were talking about the aging infrastructure in the previous segment, but old pipes in and of themselves aren't necessarily a problem as long as you continually invest in maintaining them and do adequate modernization over time. My sense is that that consistency just hasn't happened. So Aaron Packman, let me ask you something. I'm seeing here from the American Society of Civil Engineers annual infrastructure report card that America's water systems gets a C-, which is actually a little higher than I thought it would be, but not a great grade anyway. And they say that the federal government's share of capital spending in the water sector fell from 63% in 1997 to 9% of total capital spending in 2017. This is a huge drop. So that means that municipalities and states have to make up the difference. Is that part of what's driving this massively unequal scenario we have here in terms of water infrastructure in this country?
Yes, it's a simple lack of investment. I mean, water is essential for everyone, for our health. It's also an enormous economic resource, but there's just not this ongoing impetus and priority to have investment in modernization and in maintenance. Now, what you're talking about in terms of decreasing share of federal dollars, we've seen that across essentially all of government. It puts a lot more burden on the states and localities who haven't historically had to pay that much for this kind of infrastructure, and of course have had their own economic challenges. So without this consistent investment at all levels, you're left with increasing problems.
And so Catherine Coleman Flowers, help us understand a little bit more what that means for municipalities that don't have a healthy tax base. If rate payers and user fees are what's driving the available funding for maintenance and investment in a water system, does that put those communities permanently behind?
Well, let me give you another caveat. This is another side to that scenario, which I think doesn't get covered often. That's what happened in a lot of these rural and small communities. First of all, there hasn't been the investment in the first place because of racism, and environmental justice is in fact an issue. And then there's also this view of what should be in Black communities and what's acceptable there versus what's not acceptable in communities that are not communities of color. And as a result, it's almost like back in the day when they had last hired, first fired. It's the same when it comes to infrastructure. And I have seen in the 18 years that I've been working with the wastewater issue that every time federal money does come down, the same people, the same engineering firms are involved in designing systems that go into Black communities that fail. But nobody's listening to the people that live in the communities, because the people that generally get the check and leave, they're gone. And then we're left to maintain something that you can't maintain. So that's a part of the paradigm that needs to shift. And I think that largely it's informed by racism. I was just talking with, this is last week, I was talking with a person that runs a water and sewer entity in a kind of mid-sized city like Jackson. And there are Black people in that town within the city limits that do not have access to water and sewer. They have water, but they don't have sewer. They have on-site septic systems. And the person basically said, well, as long as I'm in charge, if any money comes here, we're going to give them on-site septic systems. We're not expanding the wastewater treatment to them because the developers that built their neighborhood should have put it there years ago. Now, this is somebody that just said this last week. Now, if we think back to the South, and think back to where Black people could live when they built those neighborhoods, they didn't have sewer in the first place. But it's those kinds of attitudes that I think are informing a lot of what we're seeing around the country. These are environmental justice issues. These are still, to me, remnants of the Confederacy. And people feel that there should be no sanitation equity. It should only go to those that can afford it. And I think that it is shrouded sometimes in this whole language around maintenance. If you give me a lemon, I can only maintain it to a certain point, or it's going to break down.
Okay,
but we have to deal with that.
So, but let me ask you though: I'm seeing here that there are avenues for communities to access federal funding to help with these specific water infrastructure problems. I mean, I can just name a couple. There's like this better than I do, probably, Catherine. But there's the EPA's Drinking Water State Revolving Fund appropriations. That's like more than $1 billion a year. And USDA even has a rural development program, or at least a
set USDA of programs. And USDA was cited for the racism that is shown toward Black farmers. I think the reality is that just because it's there doesn't mean people have access to it. That's why we have the inequality that exists in this country, and that's why we have the racism. And I'm glad that the Biden administration has decided that it's going to make environmental justice and equity the center of everything that it's trying to do. Otherwise, it doesn't matter that the money is there. Jackson didn't get it. I can tell you all these other places that didn't get it either, not because they didn't apply for it.
Well, so just to put some more numbers out there for people to think through, speaking of USDA, from 2015 to 2019, USDA did provide over $4.5 billion for more than 2,000 drinking water projects. But Aaron Packman, you're hearing Catherine Coleman Flowers there talk about the fact that she's seeing that money not having gone to some places that really need it. So, I mean, your thoughts about that?
So the statement was made earlier that the people here don't matter, as the Jackson story. That's also the Flint story. And we've seen this increasingly all over the country, that local communities' problems are being ignored or overridden, or even when they bring evidence, it's being ignored. I will say that all of the water engineers that I work with and that I know in governments they're good civil servants. They're doing their best to help people. They put in a lot of effort for that. However, all these decisions become political. And when you don't have enough money to address all the problems, there is a real issue of where funds get allocated.
So, you know, we've talked about municipalities and the federal government, but Aaron Packman, I mean, states have to play a role here. Do they need to step up more, or are they just, can they not because of the sheer dollar cost required for investment and maintenance in some of these places?
So they could, but as far as I know, states have mainly been involved on the regulatory side and not as much in the investment side. In the U.S., our water systems are highly fragmented, which means each municipality is typically responsible for its own water supply. And that is a barrier to this effective regional or state investment.
So I'm thinking back to the numbers that we heard about Jackson, anywhere from $600 million to about $1 billion to modernize a system in dire need, residents in dire need of reliable water. That's just for one city. I mean, Professor Packman, have we reached the point that really it is the federal government is the only institution large enough to provide the means by which to strengthen and make resilient the nation's, you know, various water systems?
I agree with that. We're in desperate need of a major reinvestment for revitalization and modernization in water infrastructure. And it really has to be national.
Okay. Well, let's hear a little bit more from what former Jackson Mayor Harvey Johnson Jr. told us about the role he wants to see the federal government play.
In terms of nationally, I just hope that, you know, this infrastructure improvements and infrastructure, the national infrastructure program has been talked about for years. It needs to be acted on now. It needs to have some relief in it for local units of government, particularly those that have a high incidence of poverty and are unable to own it on their own, improve the system.
So, Catherine Coleman Flowers, let's think about solutions here. I mean, the President Biden's going to announce a ginormous infrastructure plan sometime next week, regarding water. Where would you start? Where should early targets be for the federal government if it's going to pump a whole lot of money into infrastructure?
I think, first of all, those people that never got the infrastructure should get it first. So, I mean, in this conversation, we're talking about municipalities, but most of the United States is rural, and most of them are not in municipalities. So should they still be denied access to infrastructure, especially water and wastewater infrastructure? And we're seeing in some places, I'm actually doing a project right now with The Guardian, where we are documenting wastewater problems throughout the United States. It's not just a one situation. It's not just Jackson, Mississippi. It's not just even Detroit, you know, which is having a lot of issues and water shutoffs. And if you shut off the water, you shut off sanitation. And I think the other thing that we have to do is make sure that the policymakers, if we're going to have solutions, we cannot separate wastewater from water. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people in their mind, that because they can flush their toilets, they assume that everybody else in the U.S. can do the same thing. That's the reason why we were able to do a study to show that there was hookworm in Lowndes County. And it's probably in other areas, too. We just haven't looked for it yet. So that's the first thing we need to do. Give it to places that don't have it. We also need to identify where those places are. There are no accurate numbers on how many people do not have wastewater sanitation, because that was taken off the census in the 1990s. So if we're going to make decisions based on what numbers we have, we're still going to leave a lot of people behind. And a lot of these people are in rural communities, or they're poor people or people of color. And we have to unpack and unfold that. And I think we can't talk about infrastructure and where the dollars are going or where they have gone unless we deal with the social justice issues around those decisions. Because to people who are not like me, they see it just as simply a political decision. But socially, it has an impact on people that look like me. And we need to make sure that our voices are heard and that part of the solution is getting those dollars to those communities that have been left behind. Mm.
Aaron Packman, same question to you. Where would you start? And I think that it's taken on, these questions have taken on an even greater urgency because the pressures on these fragile water systems are only going to grow. I mean, just thinking back to Jackson, it was one storm, an unusual winter storm, but one that knocked out the whole city's water. I mean, that kind of thing is just simply going to happen more.
Yes, that's correct. So that's a combination of aging infrastructure, increasing population, and climate change that's giving us more of these extreme weather events. In terms of how to direct investments, this is a rare opportunity because you don't usually have these problems get elevated to the presidential level and a commitment to make an investment. So I would advocate for modernization of our wastewater treatment facilities, a lot of which use 50-year-old plus technology, and also fixing some of the hard problems with the water distribution system and also the wastewater system, the things that are less accessible that often get ignored and are not fully maintained. Mm. So this will be expensive, but it will make a big difference.
But, you know, we can, the nation can pulse a giant, like, bolus of money into the infrastructure of the country, the water infrastructure, and, you know, hopefully get places hooked up, first of all, as Catherine's saying, make clean water more reliable. But that doesn't necessarily mean we've had a political change in mindset about the importance of creating funding systems that that allow for continuous maintenance. Like, a point of investment at one point in time doesn't change the need for a centuries of maintenance ahead of us. So, Aaron Packman, do you see, I mean, should we be coming up with plans for creating a steady stream of funds for long-term improvement of the systems?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do agree that these funds should be distributed to smaller communities who often don't have the local resources. But keep in mind that water infrastructure is a long-term investment. A lot of the water infrastructure that we're using was built between, say, 1880, 1930 in a lot of places, and we're still using it. So if we get a big investment now, this will be good for a long time, and then you can work on the maintenance issue separately.
Yeah. Well, Catherine Coleman Flowers, we've just got about 30 seconds left to go. I'm going to give you the last thought for the day. Do you see this as a potential moment where significant change could happen, even if it's just for what Aaron Packman said, that people at higher levels are paying attention?
Well, I know that people are paying attention because we've been a part of a lot of those conversations, so I'm glad about that. But I also think that it's important to note that there are a lot of communities that are getting infrastructure and people are going to make money off this and walk away, and they're still going to have sewage running back into their homes. I would suggest that everybody read my book, Waste One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret, to know what it means for people to build infrastructure that is failing, that does not deal with climate change, and they're putting them in communities where they feel that people don't have a voice, and they blame it on maintenance. They couldn't have maintained their way out of that problem in the first place. Mm. We need to make sure that everybody has access to sustainable infrastructure.
Catherine Coleman Flowers, author of Waste, One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret, and founding director of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. Thank you so much for joining us. And Aaron Packman, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. Thank you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.